you know, that really is the time you can start to turn in a different direction, because you start to realize actually, you know, you can hold on to the positive aspects of perfectionism, but you don't have to have the insecurity that drives it. It can come from a much more optimistic and active sense of, you know, wanting to improve, wanting to grow. And also, when it comes from that place, it gives you the permission to slip up or have something go into the world that isn't quite bulletproof. And that's fine too, because the whole point about learning and growth is not the outcome, but are you moving in a forward direction? And perfectionism will always ask the question before you move in a forward direction, is it good enough?
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Run Your Life podcast. I'm host Andy Vassily. My guest today is world-renowned perfectionism expert, Professor Thomas Curran. I was really looking forward to this episode as I got my hands on a copy of his book a couple months ago. And I first found out about Thomas's work on Michael Gervais' Finding Mastery podcast, where he and Michael had an amazing conversation about Thomas's work. And that propelled me on to inviting Thomas to be a guest on my podcast, and I'm grateful that he accepted the invite. Thomas's research on perfectionism has been groundbreaking in the field of psychology, and his very impactful findings follow up on the amazing work of original perfectionism researchers, Professor Paul Hewitt and Professor Gordon Flett, who launched their studies in this area back in the 80s and 90s, at York University in Toronto, Canada. And when I think of Thomas Curran's work, a couple of quotes come to mind in regard to perfectionism and the impact it can have in people's lives. The first quote is from well-known author Brené Brown. And what Brené says is this: perfectionism is a 20-ton shield that we lug around, thinking it will protect us, when in fact it's the thing that's really preventing us from being seen and taking flight. As well, famous Canadian actor Michael J. Fox has been quoted as saying, "Perfectionism is not the pursuit of excellence, but the avoidance of failure." So with these two quotes, the point is clear. Perfectionism may seem to be a badge of honor and a characteristic that causes us to demand excellence from ourselves in regard to the work that we put out into the world, but the reality is that perfectionism can have devastatingly negative consequences in our life if we allow ourselves to be consumed and controlled by it. Thomas Curran has been very open about his own relationship with perfectionism and the negative impact that it has had in his own life over the years. So it's through this lens that he has devoted his career to deeply learning about perfectionism in order to better understand how to not only cope with it in his own life, but also provide others with a framework to deal with perfectionism in their own lives when it shows up. Thomas's current findings have shed light on the negative consequences that perfectionism causes, such as high levels of stress, anxiety, and other mental health issues. Perfectionism is characterized by an unrelenting pursuit of flawlessness and an intense fear of making mistakes, which can have profound effects on mental health, as you can imagine. While setting high standards and striving for excellence can be positive motivators, perfectionism often goes beyond healthy aspirations and can be one of the root causes of developing a very debilitating, fragile mindset. So individuals grappling with perfectionism may experience heightened levels of stress, anxiety, and depression as they constantly judge their self-worth based on unattainable ideals they hold for themselves. And one of the key challenges associated with perfectionism is the tendency to engage in all or nothing type thinking, where individuals perceive any deviation from perfection as a complete failure. This rigid mindset can lead to chronic dissatisfaction, eroding self-esteem, and result in a deep sense of inadequacy. The fear of judgment from others and the relentless pursuit of unattainable standards can also strain interpersonal relationships, creating isolation and loneliness. In our conversation today, Thomas and I unpack his amazing book, The Perfection Trap, Embracing the Power of Good Enough. World-renowned best-selling author Daniel Pink states that Thomas's book offers a hopeful beacon and a steady path for anyone struggling to find their footing in a world of impossible standards. As well, best-selling author Adam Grant describes the book as being powerful, definitive, and a must-read by all. In his book, Thomas shares some real-life examples of how perfectionism has shown up in his life, how he's learned to grapple with it by developing a more self-compassionate, non-judgmental mindset. And he also shares for the readers specific strategies to better deal with perfectionism in their own life when it shows up. This episode with Thomas is devoted to anyone who feels that perfectionism may be negatively impacting them both personally and professionally. And what we want you to know is that you are not alone, and that there are very specific things that you can do to unburden yourself with the feelings that you must be perfect or put perfect work out into the world. I really hope you enjoy my discussion with Thomas and share this episode with anyone who you feel will benefit from listening. And with that, let's jump right into my conversation with the inspiring Professor Thomas Curran. Thomas, it's fantastic to have you on the show. Just before recording, I told you how I was deeply provoked by your recent discussion with Dr. Mike Gervais on Finding Mastery. And I told you about my connection with Michael Gervais. But from that episode on, I got the book. I read the book. I began to think about my own life in terms of perfectionism. And the conversation really provoked a lot of questions within myself. And so I'm deeply honored that you have taken the time to be on the show. So thank you so much.
No problem, Andy. It's a real pleasure to be here.
So to provide some context for the listeners, can you let them know who you are, where you're from, and the work that you're most known for?
So my name is Thomas Curran. I'm a professor of psychology at the London School of Economics, and I'm best known for my research in the area of perfectionism.
And your book, The Perfectionist Trap, Embracing the Power of Good Enough, in that book, you admit to have been struggling with perfectionism in your life. So I don't know how far that goes back. Maybe you can share that in a moment. But just to frame up our discussion, I want to share a quote with you that has meant so much to me. And it's from Dr. Jim Lehrer. He's a performance psychologist. Are you familiar with Jim Lehrer's work around personal narrative?
I am, yeah.
Yeah. And I want to share this quote with you because as soon as I heard this quote, I put it up on my wall. It's been up on my wall for years, sometimes on my chalkboard wall. But as you hear the quote, I want you to think about, because for me, that quote helped me understand how I have strived to create a more empowering narrative in my life that actually serves me rather than a narrative that has caused so much pain and suffering. Yeah. So I put that quote up as a reminder. But as you listen to the quote, I want you to think about what resonates with you in terms of how you have shifted your own narrative based on the deep work you've done to better understand yourself, first of all, your relationship with perfectionism, and how you're trying to impact the world through your work with perfectionism. So the quote is this: "The power broker in your life is the voice that no one hears. How well you revisit the tone and content of your private voice is what determines the quality of your life. It's the master storyteller, and the stories we tell ourselves create our reality." So Thomas, based on your amazing, deeply impactful work, what resonates the most with you in regards to that quote and why?
Oh, that's a great quote. I think it teaches us that there is agency in the way that we treat ourselves and the way that we see the world. And then actually the most important thing at all times is to make sure that we treat ourselves kindly and with compassion, and understanding that we are just human and every human is imperfect. Nobody could be ever made perfect, and that's okay. And when we slip up, when we make mistakes, you know, those are just part and parcel of life. A learning process, a bigger thing than us. And I think that's those words are very comforting, I think, for a perfectionist to hear, because often they'll see almost the opposite internal dialogue, which is one where they have to respond to every mistake, setback, or failure with self-criticism, and can really find that that internal dialogue, rather than being our biggest supporter, can be our biggest enemy. And can absolutely hold us back. So I think it really is, for perfectionists anyway, about reflecting on our inner dialogue and softening those more self-critical elements so that we view the world more optimistically, but also more compassionately.
And when you think about your own journey, and we'll get into your book, but you know, you did the TED Talk, which was amazing. And in the TED Talk, you shared your research. You didn't share a lot about yourself. But in the book, you shared a lot about yourself and your journey to better understanding yourself, your relationship with perfectionism. But how have you been able to grapple with perfectionism in your own life? And how are you able to begin to shift your narrative to be more positive and empowering and to move you in a better direction in your life?
Well, the first thing is that you have to recognize perfectionism is what's holding you back. I think that you can't make any meaningful change until you genuinely 100% wholeheartedly embrace the idea that perfectionism is not holding you up in the world. It's not making you more successful. It's creating a lot of psychological difficulties, and at the same time, it's blocking success from all sorts of self-sabotaging behaviors like procrastination, worry, avoidance, and fear of failure. That's the first thing. You can't do anything with your perfectionism until you genuinely have taken the understanding that this is something that's holding you back. And from there, you can really start to work on the negative cognitions, negative thoughts, things about behaviors that come with perfectionism, and recognize them as negative and things that are debilitating. Those rigid thoughts, I have to, I must, it has to be so. You can really start to soften them. Diarying helps. Reframing helps. CBT has got some efficacy in this area too. But it's really about softening those irrational, debilitating beliefs, bringing them down a peg or two. It would be great if I could. The criteria of my success is not to beat everybody and everyone all around me, but is actually to do the best I can possibly do, and to grow and to improve. And those are my criteria of what it means to find purpose and be successful, rather than those kind of external barometers that we look to all the time when we have a perfectionistic mindset. So that's really the journey that you have to go on. And there's other things that I would recommend too. Things like radical acceptance is really important. Talk about positive thinking, which is useful, but that also can create its own challenges. I think sometimes it is important to let negative thoughts and feelings in, at least for a little while. Accept that the world is messy, accept that human beings are messy and imperfect, and when things go wrong, not try and push through, but actually just accept that sometimes life's just a bit crappy and that's okay. You can sit with that discomfort at least for a little while, and reflect on what is really, you know, that humanizing experience. So I think there's a lot of things there that have helped me move past my perfectionism to a point now where I feel like I'm a lot better. Not to say I'm certainly over it, but certainly can cope with setbacks and difficulty and put work out into the world much more comfortably. And it's all because of accepting that perfection is a problem, moving in a different direction.
Yeah, radical acceptance, Tara Brach, right? Absolutely. And what she talks about is this idea of just accepting reality for what it is. And one of my most recent podcast guests was the amazing George Mumford. I don't know if you know George's work, but he's a phenomenal human being who struggled so much in his life early on. He went on to coach Kobe Bryant and Michael Jordan and win 8 NBA championships as the performance coach for the Bulls and the LA Lakers. Mm. And what he talks about is this concept of Velcro gloves. And when he was on my podcast, he talked about this, and he said, he says the world, people in the world wear these Velcro gloves. So when great things happen to them, major successes, it sticks to them as part of their identity. But then when shitty things happen and, you know, they fail and they're dealing with obstacles and hardship, they try to push them away. But what happens, it sticks to them and then it becomes part of their identity. So he's saying, if you take the Velcro gloves off, you learn to sit alongside of it, recognize it, not fight it, recognize that part that exists and just give it its time and respect, but then to gracefully let it know that you no longer need it. Thank you for protecting me at one point in my life. But it's such a hard thing to do, and we can read about it all the time. And I'm sure through your research, you've done a lot of research, you've read so much. You can read every book in the world about perfectionism, do all the research you want, but unless you're going to take action to put things into practice in your life, I don't think it has significance or meaning. So talk about that idea of how do people learn to sit with perfectionism in a non-judgmental, self-compassionate way?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. It's so, so important that we learn that these things don't, you know, these mistakes and failures and difficulties, that it's not about it sticking to us as part of our identity as some kind of, you know, imperfect, flawed human being. It's just, that is what we are. We are imperfect. We do have areas of our life where we're not as competent as other areas of our life. And that's the whole point of being a human being. It's not about those things sticking to us and having to recycle them into growth or excellence or whatever it might be, but it's actually just allowing them in, giving them space to breathe alongside all the excellent parts of us too, you know, the way it places that we excel. That's just part and parcel of life. I think if we're too fixated on only excelling all time, showing our very best selves, then we deny ourselves the opportunities to do other things that might be we're not very good at, that we think we're going to be judged critically at. And that robs us of a lot of areas of joy. A lot of the things that bring us the most joy often are the things we're not the best at, but nevertheless, they bring us some kind of comfort or happiness, whether it be music or cooking or sports or whatever it might be. These are things that allow us to connect with other people and do things for the sheer fun of them. And perfectionism will hold us back if we let not being good at something stick to our identity. So I think that's so important. I think that's a really good analogy, actually, those Velcro gloves, being able to take them off and just letting all aspects of life in, not just the best ones.
You know, what people talk about or performance psychologist Jim Lehrer talks about is this idea of like welcoming the part, not attaching yourself to it, not pushing it away, inviting it to be a spectator in the stands. I value you. You've gotten me to this point, but you can watch the game from the stands, but you're not going to be behind me calling the plays, you know? Yeah. And I love that metaphor. And I can literally visualize that metaphor as a former competitive athlete. And I wish I would have had that skill when I was a competitive athlete. But when you think about perfectionism, even though you've been in this game a long time, being a lifelong learner, the question I want to ask you is, what did you used to think perfectionism is, and now what do you think it is based on your most current research? And what is a recent aha moment you've had in regards to better understanding perfectionism and how it's manifested in people's lives?
I didn't used to think perfectionism was a badge of honor, definitely. Something that I would wear with pride and show off to everyone and all around me. Kind of veil or cloak of hyper-functioning. But you realize once it starts to take over your life and have some really severe negative consequences on your well-being, actually it's just fear. That's all it is. It's just fear of not being good and being seen as less than. And all of that energy and all of that perfecting and hard work and high standards and all of the things that we ostensibly think are very positive is just compensation for fear. And once you make that breakthrough with perfectionism, that's, you know, that really is the time you can start to, you can start to turn in a different direction, because you start to realize actually, you know, you can hold on to the positive aspects of perfectionism, but you don't have to have the insecurity that drives it. It can come from a much more optimistic and active sense of, you know, wanting to improve, wanting to grow. And also, when it comes from that place, it gives you the permission to slip up or have something go into the world that isn't quite bulletproof. And that's fine too, because the whole point about learning and growth is not the outcome, but are you moving in a forward direction? And perfectionism will always ask the question before you move in a forward direction, is it good enough? Mm. Is it bulletproof? Is it ready? And so it blocks progress. It doesn't help us. And so, yes, perfectionism looks like hyper-functioning, but when you understand and realize that it's just fear, that's when you can really begin to break down its much more pervasive features and start to recognize them in yourself and begin to put into place management strategies that allow you to take a different direction.
And Dr. Gabor Maté, famous Canadian psychologist, one of his quotes that has really resonated with me, my wife has studied under him and is a certified therapist under his compassionate inquiry approach. And what Gabor Maté says is, the attempt to escape pain only creates more of it.
Yeah.
So it's learning to grapple with that. And, you know, I was thinking about you today. I went for a run on the track near here, and I was kind of putting together the questions I wanted to ask you and all my curiosities. And I was drawn back during my run to your grandfather. And I was actually, you tell the story of your grandfather, and he was a woodworker, and he released beautiful work into the world without ever wanting anything more. So although he had high expectations of self and product, it seemed to me that he put a lot of value and pride in the process of developing his craft and putting his craft out into the world. And I could actually picture some of the pubs. You talked about the pubs and going with your father for a pint and seeing your grandfather's woodworking around you and how special that must be. But
yeah, when it really is.
Yeah. Is your grandfather still alive?
Unfortunately not, but it's that, you know, in some ways it makes it more special to go to those places, and it's a reminder of him. It's incredible, actually.
Yeah. What would he say to you about how you're using his story as a metaphor, and what would he be most proud of you about?
Well, he's a very modest man, and I'm sure he would he'd make a joke. He was an Irish fella, and he would dismiss any praise that I put heaped on him with a joke. But nevertheless, I think he would understand what I'm driving at, because he would see it all around him. You know, and a lot of that generation, they'll tell you the same. It's not just my grandfather. There was just a different world. It was a different culture, and the work was the vocation of the work was the most important thing. You know, bringing and making things and putting things into the world for other people to use. that was the purpose. And you know, especially back in those days, where, you know, the economic development wasn't what it is today, and scarcity was a real big driver of people's work ethic. You know, they had to do these things. It is really, really important, not just for themselves, but also for the betterment of society. It's just an affluent society. The middle classes were growing out. It felt like the economy was moving forward, and everyone had their role in it. So I think we have to be also aware that there's a very a specific point in time. It's a very cultural thing too. But nevertheless, like my grandfather, I think, would be very proud that his grandson was able to publish a book and use his story to highlight, I think, a key difference or something that perhaps we've lost when it comes to our work, and that's the vocation.
Yeah. Going back to your TED Talk, what I wondered about, you know, I did my own TED Talk about my past and the dysfunctional environment, family environment I had to overcome. I lost a brother to suicide. I lost a brother to drug addiction, but team sport is what gave me very clear, precise direction in my life and empowered me. And I remember preparing for my TED Talk, and I thought, I felt a nudge that this is what I have to talk about. And I had to go to the TED committee and like you did and share the drafts, and they gave feedback and they said, this is going to be great. It's going to fit in perfectly. But as the day came up, I became more and more afraid to share my authentic self on the red carpet, the circular red carpet. And when I heard your story and saw you standing there sharing your story, you flew to California, I think. Was it in California?
Yeah, Palm Springs.
Yeah. I just remember what that was like. And there was a moment I was running, going for a long run. It was here at the university. I'm in Saudi Arabia, based in Saudi Arabia at a science and technology university. And I was running a few days before, and then suddenly I was overcome with fear, tremendous fear. And I thought, there's no way I'm going to give this talk, because I'm going to share a deeply vulnerable part of myself. And suddenly I got scared, and I thought, oh, I've done so many talks about education and this and that. I got lots of things I can go to. I'll just tell the committee that I'm not going to do this talk. I'm going to do it about education. But by the time I got back, I came to a clearer sense of mind, right? And the question that I have for that, based on me sharing that, is vulnerability. And I just want to know, like, when you put together your amazing TED talk and even writing your book, how much of a risk did it feel to you at the time? And how did you overcome any struggles you had in terms of being vulnerable and sharing such a deep part of yourself?
It's a really good question, Andy. And it's really interesting that you mentioned vulnerability, because it's probably the most daunting, courageous thing you could possibly do, is to share a piece of yourself on the open stage in the hope that other people will find inspiration or find solace in the words. You don't know whether it's going to land. You feel like you could crumble under the pressure, because it's such a big a moment. And all of those things were part of my own psychology as well. And it's tough. But you know what? Like, I think the perfectionism will always tell you in the run-up to these events that this is going to be catastrophic. Like, something's going to happen and it's going to go wrong, and this is what's going to happen. Like, the catastrophizing in the event of difficulty, setback, or things going not quite to plan becomes so intense that that's what really stops it. And there are many moments across my own journey where I was like, I'm going to have to pull out of this. I can't do this. Like, I can't recite 15 minutes. It's too much pressure. I've got to stand in front of all these people with the bright lights, this big circle, and it's so scary. I'm not sure I can do this. But yeah, you know, you push yourself, then you do it. And it's almost like you realize that your perfectionism is telling you that there is parts of you that aren't going to be capable of this, and then you realize you actually are capable of this in the moment once you've done it. And there's something quite refreshing about that. Liberating about that, I suppose. You still worry. I mean, I write in the book about how I was constantly concerned about how it went down, and I wasn't sure it landed very well because I didn't think it was a very good talk, but that's a very perfectionistic mindset. And the book is a similar experience. You know, I didn't want to let it go. My editor was ready to throttle me, I think, by the end of it, because I couldn't let it go. Mm-hmm. But then you do let it go, and you realize that the catastrophization you've gone through in your mind is to, you know, if you get critical feedback, is not nowhere near as bad as you thought it would be. And sharing vulnerability in the book is a really challenging part. But the most difficult thing for me is that, for me anyway, is not the vulnerability, but more, you know, I'm of the Gabor Mate camp. You know, I think these problems are systemic, they're cultural, mm-hmm. and they occur by living in a dysfunctional society. That's challenging for a lot of people to hear, particularly in the US, I'm afraid to say. And I knew that I was going to get pushback for the final chapter, which very much took on those systemic issues in very direct terms. And that's been the most challenging. That was the most challenging. It wasn't a vulnerability. It was mm-hmm. going against the grain. Mm-hmm. But again, my perfectionism was telling me not to do that. Don't do that. Don't do that. And there's kind of almost a very dogmatic side, principled side of me that was like, no, I'm doing it anyway. And again, you know, it has been criticized on those terms. And there have been reviews that are very critical of those last parts of the book. But you know what? It's nowhere near as bad as you build it up to in your mind. Mm. that's the most liberating thing. You know, you build these things up, you think it's going to be catastrophic, and you actually find out, and it's not as catastrophic. It's like taking a sledgehammer to perfectionism. So it's, you know, long-winded saying, if you're a perfectionistic person, vulnerability is something you're going to guard very, very close. But it's so important that you show that vulnerability, that you feel the fear, you put things out there, because that's like taking the sledgehammer to perfectionism.
Yeah, and that's beautiful, because what Michael Gervais says is this idea, all we can control are our thoughts, our words, our actions. And Jim Lehrer talks about aligning to core values. And when we stay as closely aligned as possible to our core values and what matters most, that is going to bring most fulfillment, even though there may be fallback. So it sounds to me that in your TED talk and in the book, you were deeply aligned to your core values and what you have come to understand about the world through your work, and having the courage to share that despite the criticism that might descend upon you. So when you look at your core values, do the core values you hold now reflect the core values you might not have been aware of as a child, as a young person growing up, but is there some connection between the core values you now hold and the core values of younger Thomas?
Well, you know, first of all, what's really interesting is I constantly doubt myself. So I have core values, and you know, I grew up in a small town, working class town, but didn't have a great deal. My parents were on welfare, which is unemployment benefit for the US for a long time. So I'm a welfare kid of the state. And I carried a lot of those insecurities with me, still do, you know. But it also made me realize that like opportunity and love is not created equally. And just because I made it, I wasn't gonna turn my back on the plight of the kids and communities that I grew up with. I wasn't gonna suddenly turn around and say, well, actually, you know, if you work hard, you'll make it. My rise to the top is a story of hard work, but it's also a story of incredible luck, circumstance, being in the right place at the right time, meeting the right people that could have happened to me but could have not happened to me. And I may be, you know, be in a completely different place if it hadn't happened. So, you know, those are my core values, you know, but for the grace of God, go I. I'm not a religious person, but that is one of the things that certainly I think about a lot. And so, yes, I do have a lot of principles, but I am also very unsure of them, very uncertain of them. They're very shaky in my mind because I doubt myself a lot. And some of my critics are the most confident in what's right and what works of people that I've ever met. I constantly doubt myself. But sometimes I think you have to hold on to what you think is right. And for me, perfectionism, mental health issues around stress and security, these are systemic. These are things that are culturally conditioned to a large extent, and as a consequence, it's not just about individual solutions, it's also about societal solutions, and that's the hill I'll die on. I'm sure. And you know, whether people agree with me, whether people don't agree with me, are things that I'm just going to have to take on the chin. But that is a very, very core value of mine, and something that I'm very passionate about.
Yeah, and when you share, you give people permission to share, and that's what I found in my TED talk. I did it. I was so relieved. Like, you talk about the sense of relief with perfectionism, and I was like, I don't know, am I a perfectionist? There was definitely a sense of relief when I was done my TED talk, but I had a person come up to me and tap me on the shoulder and said, my story, your story, my story. And he walked away. I was like, oh, that was cool. And the next day he was a world renowned climatologist that just happened to be at the university giving a talk that week. And he opened up about his drug addiction and being addicted to cocaine and all of his struggles in life, and how he found ultra marathoning, and how ultra marathoning led to him finding greater purpose in life and pursuing academics. And then he's doing the work he's now doing. And I use that as a metaphor for every single time you share, even though it's difficult, and you're sharing from the most authentic place in your heart, the deepest place in your heart, you're giving permission to people to think about sharing, or actually sharing, shifting them, right? And I believe to this day, there's no greater gift than that.
There's not.
Yeah. And go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, as that is so important for people to hear, because, you know, we all have our lives, we all have our jobs, but there are things that we do on a day-to-day basis that get us from A to B. And those are the things that obviously we need to do to survive. But beyond that, there's space in our lives to impact. And I think it's so important that we are do give ourselves the permission to be vulnerable, share our stories, because you don't know, there are people out there who have exactly the same experiences, and there's a lot of solace and community and connection to be found in those experiences. If all we do is sharing our perfect lives and lifestyles on social media or in YouTube or whatever, you know, that's a very manufactured fake sense of reality. If we're real, then there's something very, basically something very connecting about vulnerability. And I think it does bring people together. It gives us a sense of purpose in our lives. So I think it's so, so important, vulnerability.
You know, so in our time left, I know that you have to teach in 22 minutes and we have about 17 minutes left. And I want to dive into your book now, because I think your book is extremely powerful for anybody, but in particular, any educators listening to this, whether they're a principal, a director, a superintendent of a school, a teacher, whatever your role is, I think it's super powerful for you to think about how perfectionism might be showing up in the classroom or in a school setting. But I want you to talk about your book, Thomas, and putting it together. But before that, I'm just going to give people a bit of a background. There's four parts to it. Part one, what is perfectionism? Part two, what does perfectionism do to us? Part three, where does perfectionism come from? Part four, how can we embrace imperfection in a republic of good enough? So what do you want the listeners, regardless of who they are, to most know about this book? And what are you most proud of?
Well, I think the biggest thing, I mean, there's a few intentions I had, but one was to bust a few myths. The first is that perfectionism is good for us. I think that was a really big and important myth to bust. And I do that through various means, but mainly through, this is where a lot of the empirical research is in the book, showing through detailed meta-analyses and lab studies how perfectionism is a blocking factor in success, and creates all sorts of psychological difficulties, not just those related to compulsive tendencies, but, you know, anxiety, depression, low mood, feelings of helplessness and hopelessness too, like lots and lots of very, very significant mental health problems. So it doesn't give you success. It breeds a lot of psychological distress. I wanted to show that it wasn't high standards at all. High standards were just the cloak for fear, as I mentioned. And then I really wanted to delve into what's going on at a societal level, why it is that more and more people are reporting high levels of perfectionism, and that's what we're seeing in the data. Yes, there's genes, which is a big part of it. We mustn't discount that. But beyond genes, perfectionism is all around us. And I wanted to paint a picture of perfectionism as a cultural phenomenon, I suppose, a way of coping. This goes back to the overlap, I suppose, with Gabor Mate's ideas around it's a way of acculturating to a dysfunctional culture, right? A fitting in, feeling like we matter. And as a consequence, you have to follow that logic through. You can't then jump to individual solutions if the problem is the culture you live inside. And so that's why the final part is dedicated really to trying to think almost as a thought experiment about how we could create a society in which good enough, or a republic of good enough, where we don't have to feel insecure all the time, or we don't have to feel perfect just to get by, you know, where there's a floor in the poverty, where inequality is not as vast, where we focus on human progress and social development indicators rather than that naked pursuit of economic growth, where we embrace technology and AI to allow us more time in our communities and in our homes, but not just to give us more work to do, you know, use the tools that are available to us to enrich our lives, to take that insecurity away and allow us to flourish, you know, to drive economic activity from a starting point of abundance rather than scarcity. And I think all of those things, if we were able to put them into place, would melt away the pressure and the need for each and every one of us to be perfect just to get by. And so that for me is really the genesis of the book. It's what I want people to take away. As we mentioned, some people think that's great. Other people think it's a total disaster. But nevertheless, I want to at least start the debate and move the conversation in that direction, because I think it's much needed.
which says to me, you want to create a curious mindset and just be open to these ideas instead of judging them. Let's just talk about what is and what's happening. And Gabor Mate's recent book, The Myth of Normal, really emphasizes what you're talking about.
Absolutely.
It seems like normal is all around us. But really, if you double click on normal, what's really revealed, right?
Yeah.
So talk about the types of perfectionism. There's three types of perfectionism: self-oriented, socially prescribed, other-oriented. But just give a brief outline into each of those and how practical examples of how those are manifested in everyday life.
Yes, that's the thing about perfectionism. It's really curious. It's a lot of people recognize perfectionism as sort of high self-set goals, excessive steep achievement striving, and that's part of it. But it's not the only part. You talk to perfectionistic people and you reflect on your own perfectionism if you're a perfectionistic person, you'll know that it's not just about those self-set standards. This is called self-oriented perfectionism. But there's also a social component to this, and a very strong social component at that. Just as we expect ourselves to be perfect, there's also a sense that other people expect us to be perfect. So the outside world has pressures and people are waiting and they're going to judge us if we're less than or seen as less than perfect in their eyes. And so this is a social element of perfectionism called socially prescribed perfectionism. So just as we feel we need to be perfect, we also feel other people expect us to be perfect. And there's a third element of perfectionism you see a lot, which is called other-oriented perfectionism, which is perfectionism that's turned outwards onto other people. So I expect myself to be perfect. So of course you're going to have to be perfect too, right? That's only fair. And so these three elements of perfectionism really make up what we call a multidimensional perspective on perfectionism, whereby it isn't just those high self-set goals and standards that we think it is, or most people think it is anyway, but actually it's much broader than that. It operates within a social context. And as a consequence, there are important social considerations for perfectionistic people. And so we've done a lot of work in this area. We've identified the three elements. And one of the most interesting things from the research that we've done is that what we're seeing right now is an explosion in socially prescribed perfectionism. So that social element is really, really rising very rapidly in Western culture. And that should concern us, because that is the most extreme form of perfectionism. It's also the form of perfectionism that's most strongly correlated with psychological distress.
Manifested by anxiety, go into the actual mental disorders that are being manifested as a result of socially prescribed perfectionism, but also self-oriented and other-oriented.
Yeah, absolutely. So socially prescribed perfectionism is a mindset where essentially we feel like we're being judged or surveilled all the time. And so as a consequence, it's really important that we don't slip up and that we receive other people's approval, you know, people's likes, mentions, fire emojis, you know, the recognition essentially that we're okay, that we're good enough. Look, that's really problematic, because it's fine if we're getting other people's recognition and approval, but as soon as other people show us indifference or rejected or criticized in some way, or we slip up publicly, which we can often do, then that's extremely problematic for our self-esteem. It plummets in those moments. Feel a lot of shame and guilt for revealing those imperfections to other people. And of course, look, if you're doing that day after day, week after week, month after month, your mood declines, anxiety creeps into your life, depression starts to spike, a lot of really negative psychological consequences can start to become entrenched, because you're living your life in fear. Again, idea of fear of not being seen to be perfect by other people. So it's extremely problematic, which is why we're so worried about it rising so fast. Now, self-oriented perfectionism has a similar set of outcomes, but there's a slightly different process. So self-oriented perfectionists put themselves under a lot of pressure, right? They try and strive to be as perfect as they possibly can. And when things are going reasonably well, that's okay. But when things start to go wrong, you start to see them go in on themselves, lots of self-criticism, lots of self-castigation. But not only that, in the good times, they can't derive a lasting sense of satisfaction. So they have a sort of brief hit of pride, but it's not very long lasting. In fact, it's extremely fleeting, because they're always thinking about the next thing. And the better they do, the better they expect themselves to do. So it's kind of almost like a never-ending treadmill. So you never feel much joy particularly when things have gone well, and you're extremely self-critical when things haven't gone so well. So again, you can begin to see how that also doesn't lend itself to very positive mental health outcomes either. So these two aspects, self-aware and socially prescribed, they have a lot of very strong correlations with psychological difficulties. And I think when you look closer at them and the mechanism by which they impact people's lives, you can see why.
When I was thinking about and going through your book and looking at the work of Fletton Hewitt, who you credit in the book from York University in Toronto, we're from Toronto. So, you know, that really struck a chord being on at Rafferty's pub, or, you know, in Toronto when you met them and had beers with them and were talking and were so curious, and then one beer led to another. That's an amazing story. But I just think about that idea of blind spots. So yes, they did this great self-assessment, but we all know that when we do self-assessments, if we have blind spots, we can't actually self-assess ourselves.
Absolutely.
In an authentic way. So somebody who may have blind spots to their own perfectionism may not even know they're perfectionist, and they may never have a conversation that brings that out. So how might people with blind spots around perfectionism begin to ask themselves the right questions to understand that this might be showing up in their life?
Well, absolutely. And you see this a lot. A lot of people with perfectionistic tendencies won't necessarily see themselves as perfectionistic people, particularly if you're really high on social, or you think other people are judging you and waiting to pounce if you're not perfect. That's a very high, there's a very high chance that if you're very high on social and quite low on self-oriented, that you might not recognize yourself as a perfectionist because you don't have those high self-oriented tendencies, but nevertheless, you are still feeling compelled by forces outside of you to put on your best possible face, mm-hmm. right? And so I think there's a real, you know, there's definitely, and you'll see this a lot in the clinic, by the way, talk to clinicians, they're constantly wrestling with it. They're seeing perfectionistic tendencies, our perfectionistic tendencies come through, and yet convincing people that perfectionism is underneath this is really difficult because they don't consider themselves to be perfectionistic. And by the way, this was me as well. Like I failed to recognize in myself that perfectionism was what was creating a lot of the difficulty. So I do definitely recognize it too. Look, you know, and the other problem you have, of course, is that perfectionism is seen as positive. So trying to change that is really difficult because people will hold on to it for dear life. It's like, you know, everything else is crumbling around me, but I've got my perfectionism. So they'll be on the other end of the spectrum where they'll identify the perfectionism to such an extent that they'll never let it go. And so that this is why perfection, one of the reasons why perfection is really, really tricky to treat. Because, you know, it's difficult to get people to recognize perfectionism as the difficulty. And then it's also difficult on the one hand, it's difficult to convince people to let go of it. So yes, absolutely, we do have blind spots. But that was another reason why I wanted to write the book, is just try to elucidate these processes, get people to self-identify or reflect on their tendencies to understand, mm-hmm. Maybe there is a little bit of perfectionism in there. And if so, that's something that perhaps we need to address.
Yeah, and that might show up in emotional triggers, whatever it is, but just be curious to those triggers and be aware of them and just be curious about them. So in closing, I just want to ask you, from my understanding, you've just recently had a baby, maybe what is 6 months old, 8 months old?
Yeah, very, very, very small 6 months.
Okay. And what I want you to project forward to is when is son, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So when your son is 30 years old, I assume you will still be healthy, vital, and strong. But when you think of your future son as an adult, what is it that you want them to be most proud of about in regards to you and how you've changed lives through your work? And what lessons will you have instilled within them that have helped them navigate the world in a way where perfectionism is on the side and they're pursuing what matters most? So when you think of that and project forward, what comes up?
I just want to, I mean, it's a cliche, but I want them to be happy, contented. I think that's so important. And it's really difficult in modern society to have those things in regularity because we're constantly told we need to be more, have more, do more. I think the biggest lesson for me is that you know, it's okay sometimes to not excel. You don't have to be the 0.01% unicorn achiever. Like, that's not the criteria of success. The criteria of success is, I suppose, going back to my grandfather, you know, what is your why? What is your purpose? And I'll constantly try to impress those things as being way more important than what's on the outside, and the ostensive achievements and things you can point to, and the trophies and all the rest of it, because you know they don't matter. What matters is how you're making an impact. What's your purpose? That's where your contentment, that's where your joy comes from. And actually, you know, it's interesting you asked me this question, because the final chapter of my book, I think it's going to read way, way better in 15, 20 years' time than it is today. And in some ways, I would like my son, when he's old enough to read it, to hopefully see that his dad was thinking about these issues that are coming down the road, seeing how this is a broader problem than just the individual, and recognizing that we do need as a society to begin to take action against all sorts of things that are coming down the road, and not least of which the impacts of climate change on the planet and human beings. So I would like him to hopefully read the book and say that at least my dad tried to say something, yeah. Even though the impact was extremely small, but at least there was an attempt made, and I think that's probably what made me finally send that final chapter into the world, was the knowledge that it may read radical today, but I think it will read quite mainstream in 15, 20 years time, is my expectation. And I could be completely wrong about that too.
No, I think you're right. I think you're right.
But I hope my son, when he's able to read it, recognizes that that there were people talking about these things and warning about these things. It's just we sadly weren't listened to. But you know, maybe technology will come and save the day. And I am praying for that. Trust me. If we could solve the growth problem, and we could get nuclear fusion online, and we could power the world in green ways, then I'm all for growth. You know, take the afterburners off, go for it. But we're not there, and what we're seeing is quite a scary future if we don't take action. So that's my big hope for my son in the future, and hopefully we can have that conversation when we're 30.
Yeah,
we'll see.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And what you say so eloquently is, be consistent as a parent in messaging about success and failure. That, yeah. You know, that's unconditional positive regard, regardless of success or failure. And I really take that to heart as a parent myself. And where can people find you on social media?
I'm on LinkedIn. You can find me there. If you Google Thomas Curran Affection Trap, my website will come up, and all sorts of social links will be related to that search. So yeah, do find me. If you read the book, I would love to hear from you. I really like to hear from readers. So do get in touch. But yeah, otherwise, thank you, Andy, for the chat. It's been great.
Yeah, thank you, Thomas. It's been wonderful. And I will put a challenge out there for people to share what resonates the most with them. And hopefully many listeners will buy your book, because it's game changing in terms of their own performance and the way they want to show up and what they need to better understand about themselves. So thank you, Thomas. Have a wonderful holiday.
Thank you, Andy. Appreciate it. Take care.
Okay.
Singing life like a church hymn. You are gonna find your place, child. Of that much I know, I'm sure. Keep on laughing at the rain, I guess. Isn't that the place to start? Someday you will be stronger than you are now. You will not know everything. And when the water's spilling over the bow, you'll still have me in the wings. You gotta get up to get down, kid. You gotta get down to get up again. You gotta get up to get down, kid. Gotta get down to get up again. daughter like she's made of gold. After all, she brought you here. And if you're lost, go see the ocean. It will always help you steer. Someday you will be stronger than you are now. But you will not know everything. And when the water's spilling over the bow, you're still happy in the winds. You gotta get up to get down, kid. You gotta get down to get up again. You gotta get up to get down, kid. You gotta get down to get up again. Than I am now, and I still won't know everything. But when I'm passing up and over the clouds, I hope that you'll have learned from me. Someday you will be stronger than you are now, but you will not know everything. When the water's spilling over the bow, you'll still have me in the wings. You gotta get up to get down, kid. You gotta get down to get up again. You gotta get up to get down, kid. You gotta get down to get up again. Gotta get up to get down, kid. You gotta get down to get up again. You gotta get up to get down, kid. Hey. You gotta get down to get.